Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program presented by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Stephen Venuto. I'm partner and co-head of ORIC's Emerging Companies Group. ORIC is a global law firm and one of the leading advisors to the technology industry here in Silicon Valley and around the world. Our AHA speaker series in partnership with the Commonwealth Club is so named because our goal is to inspire the delighted discovery of ideas. Those AHA moments, and I can assure you that there was no one better qualified to lead us in that pursuit than tonight's speaker, U.S. Technology Officer Anish Chopra. Before I introduce Anish, let me note that we are also pleased to have Michael Moritz, managing member of Sequoia Capital, moderating this evening's question and answer session following Anish's talk. We all know Michael for his roles with many of Silicon Valley's most successful companies, past, present, and future, Yahoo, Google, and Gamefly, to name a few. What you may not know is that before he became a venture capitalist, he was Time Magazine's San Francisco bureau chief, so he should be well-versed with the questions and answers. When I first heard that I was being asked to introduce Anish Chopra tonight, I immediately thought of a conversation that I had with then-Senator, now-President Obama, at a reception early in the campaign season in Chicago. Near the end of the reception, a mutual friend encouraged me to talk with then-Senator Obama. We spoke one-on-one and spent the time talking about technology, how amazing it was that a Harvard dropout was changing the world again using technology, how important technology and brilliant entrepreneurs were to the Obama campaign, and ultimately, and most importantly, how important technology and innovation are to the government and the people of the United States. The word CTO did not pass President Obama's lips, but the description of Anish Chopra's future job were in the air. With the Chief Technology Officer role, our government has finally created a position that, when filled by someone brilliant, energetic, and creative, can revolutionize the nature of the way our nation uses technology to meet some of the key challenges of our nation: job creation, reducing healthcare costs, and improving education, energy independence, and national security. Since his confirmation to the position of CTO 1 year ago, Anish Chopra has tirelessly led the charge in these areas and focused our nation on using technology to improve the lives of Americans. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe Anish Chopra is that brilliant, energetic, and creative person, and I'm happy to introduce him here to you today. Please join me in welcoming the Chief Technology Officer of the United States, Anish Chopra.
I want to thank you for those very, very kind remarks. I hope I live up even to a modest amount of those expectations. Tonight, it'll be my pleasure to provide for you a quick overview of where we are and where we're heading in the President's commitment to building a future in our economy that's born out of a commitment to advanced information technology and broader innovative capabilities. In my remarks tonight, my ambition is to both share with you what we're doing in Washington, but in equal parts, more importantly, to call on you to participate and engage in ways that perhaps you may not have imagined before you walked into tonight's session. So without much further ado, I'd like to get started with a little message from the boss, which got us pretty excited just a few weeks ago.
Hello, everybody. I want to talk with you about a new consumer website, healthcare.gov. It's a good resource for understanding the new law, and it offers a few simple tools to help you take your healthcare into your own hands.
I bring that particular clip to mind because as we have these larger debates in Washington around a whole range of issues, and sometimes those of us that are witnessing this from the outside might say, this looks like a difficult process, a sausage-making process. It's unclear how much value there is. Emerging from a big and healthy debate we had around our healthcare system and what the future might look like, in less than 2 months, the President assembled a crack team of entrepreneurs. In fact, a Silicon Valley alum, my colleague and dear friend Todd Park, serving as the Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services, was tasked with the responsibility of standing up the nation's first key deliverable to ensure that the American people understand how and in what manner the new health care reform bill would translate into improving their everyday lives. Now, with a crack team, a commitment to entrepreneurship, and the President's focus and understanding about how technology, data, and innovation might transform both our economy and our everyday lives, our team went hard at work to figure out some basic principles. Basic principle number one: we should understand the customer's experience or the customer's journey. as we went to design our healthcare portal. The first principle was understand who needs help. A small business owner, a young family, perhaps a parent of a child looking for care for their loved one. And we designed this program with those key elements in mind. Second, we understood the importance that in Washington, one of the policy tools that we have that we can leverage when it comes to making information, our society work better, is accessing new and creative amounts of information. How many of you would have known how many health insurance options there are in your neighborhood or in your community? There had been startups in Silicon Valley that had attempted to engage on this question, and it has been a difficult task. But because we had the legal authority, we were able to, in less than 4 weeks' time, inventory every possible insurance option for every zip code in the United States. There are almost 17 options in every zip code, and all that data is freely available as we've gathered it. And third, perhaps most interesting, as we took advantage of this, we understood that one of the key challenges in our nation's health insurance market is the difficulty in gathering pricing data. It's so hard to compare. There's no equivalent of, for lack of a better term, the Expedia.com for health insurance plans. So as part of our commitment to getting this right, well in advance of the more difficult legal challenges that will come out over the course of the next several years, we committed that by October of this year, we will have pricing data for every plan in America widely accessible and available through this very simple portal. We believe that Americans will see benefits from this information, and even better, those who can capture that information in the entrepreneurial ecosystem and build even better navigation tools, because that data is going to be available for the American people to use in ways they'd ever imagined. It's why the president said, as my homework assignment on his first full day in office before I was actually named to the post, that he wanted the chief technology officer immediately to develop a set of recommendations on how we make our government more transparent, more participatory, and more collaborative. It's not just about the workings of government. It's also about an understanding about our economic prospects. A year ago today, when I had the honor of joining in this very room a summary of where our nation is on a global index, I shared with us the sobering news that from the years 1999 to 2009, the decade, the United States had the lowest rate of improvement on a collection of about 20-some indicators of global competitiveness. And I shared with you the challenge that while we have been at the top of our game on a number of these indicators, the fact that we've shown such little movement while other countries in many cases have surpassed our performance was a wake-up call that said we have to put more time and energy here. I had highlighted two specific initiatives of interest to the government, to the president, the first of those being to ensure that we have an electronic government or a government infrastructure that connects to the American people, and second, that we achieve the long-term economic prospects of the country by having a workforce that's skilled to compete globally. I'm pleased to report that literally months ago, the United Nations announced their 2010 updates to their e-government index. The United States made modest but improved performance. We went from fourth to second in the world, and we're looking to get our strategies in place to be even more effective still. And the president announced, and we've seen a funding commitment by our Congress, to promote the president's American Graduation Initiative, which calls for the United States to once again lead the world in the share of the adult population with college degrees by the year 2020. It is the president's commitment to this long-term future, rested on a foundation of technology and innovation, that I had the honor and privilege of joining the president when he released the strategy in September of 2009. Just by a brief show of hands, have any of you read or heard of the president's strategy for American innovation? Thank you for a number of you that have been paid attention. I want to give you a quick run-through of that strategy because I believe it is at the heart. While we are in our economic challenges, the question is, how might we think beyond the current economic challenge towards a future of long-term economic success? The president has said that that rests on three fundamental pillars. Our first pillar is that we as a nation are at our best when we invest in the building blocks of innovation. Those building blocks are ensuring that we have a highly skilled workforce, we have the next generation of infrastructure, not just physical, but also digital, and that we have, for the purposes of our long-term economic prospects, a research and development infrastructure that will help to identify the scientific and technological breakthroughs of the future. Second, we have a commitment to productive entrepreneurship and ensuring that we have an open and competitive marketplace that rewards those which we've seen so successful here in the Valley and throughout the United States. And last but not least, the President did outline a few key areas where we need an all-hands-on-deck approach. The President said that in the areas of healthcare, IT, and in the connection between technology and our energy sector, the smart grid, we should catalyze breakthroughs as best we can. A word on each of these principles, and Michael, I'd love to join you for some conversation. So let me get to the hard work about building up our skills in our overall economy. We have a commitment to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that emanates from the President's top set of priorities all the way through, and a commitment within our technology team to deliver innovations not in years or in congressional cycles, which tend to go even beyond years, but in quarterly deliverables. I go back to the fall of 2009 when we were struggling with what to do with H1N1 to see whether or not our school systems would be struggling to bring back the students in case the virus had come back stronger. So instantly, Secretary Duncan, on behalf of the president, had called on our school systems and our supply chain in the educational market to stand up web-based delivery and instruction services just in case we needed to have a backup plan if our schools had to shut down for longer periods of time. 3 months after that, the president announced the Educate to Innovate campaign, a purely privately run collaboration led by Craig Barrett, Ursula Burns, and Sally Ride, the astronaut, to galvanize our entrepreneurial ecosystem, our corporations, to think about how we instill science, technology, engineering, and mathematics into the grassroots, school by school, community by community, throughout this country. 3 months after that, we unearthed a grant program that was to focus on investments in innovation and breakthroughs in learning. We had modest amounts of capital, about $650 million. And what we said is, let's create an open platform at innovation.ed.gov where anybody with an entrepreneurial idea to improve our school system, ranked, of course, a number of key dimensions of policy priority, could have their voice heard without actually having to formalize a grant application or a process, just to get their voice into the ecosystem. And then 3 months thereafter, we had the official applications process, where thousands of people around the country submitted their ideas to compete for our $650 million in funding. We just announced last week our 49 finalists that represent the best and the brightest of those applications to spur breakthroughs in education. And here's where technology, data, and innovation come in. We've posted summaries of each of those 49 finalists on our data.ed.gov platform, and we're encouraging you, the American people, to engage with those applications and determine if any of them merit your support. Because by law, each of those grant recipients have to bring up matching funds for their programs. Rather than require the grant funds to be matched before they applied, we are giving them a window until September 8th, once they've been deemed high-quality applications, to find out if they can gather the support from the American people to see those ideas through. I encourage you to visit data.ed.gov to see if there are breakthroughs in education that you would like to support in the context of matching funds. In the areas of research and development, the President has tasked his Council of Advisors for Science and Technology, led by co-chairs Eric Schmidt at Google and Shirley Ann Jackson at Rensselaer Polytech, to think through how we build a robust infrastructure that, frankly, the government is best positioned to offer that will enable the creation of new bio, nano, and information technology products and innovations that will ultimately lead to new jobs and increases in GDP growth. We had the honor and privilege of bringing a whole range of rock stars under the age of 35, although it was not age limited, who were describing for us the world that they're researching as it might be a decade from today, to understand where there may be opportunities for leverage, where we're getting in the way and we have to stop, and what we can do as an ecosystem to support and nurture and scale those ideas that work. All of this is publicly available on our website. If you visit the ostp.gov, you can download and participate in that public hearing. It's fascinating. One of the areas that came out of that workshop that is in the president's in the budget guidance for the president's fiscal 2012 budget was a commitment at applying advanced manufacturing principles in R&D to support our manufacturing sector, specifically by focusing on areas like robotics, cyber-physical systems, and flexible manufacturing. Platforms for long-term economic growth that is at the heart of our research and development strategy. But it would be wrong for us to talk about infrastructure without acknowledging that we are undergoing a sea change in how our society operates, especially in the communication standpoint. We are in the midst of a mobile broadband revolution, and a key asset necessary for success in that mobile broadband revolution is the ability to access government-held spectrum or government-controlled spectrum. The president announced just a few weeks ago a commitment to double or nearly double the amount of wireless spectrum available for mobile broadband use across the next 10 years. And our commitment that by the October month, we will have an overarching strategy and framework to not only encourage private access to spectrum, but also to free up government spectrum that could then be released into the private sector. We have a number of key principles that are at the heart of our spectrum initiative. Those principles include that target goal of 500 megahertz to be released over the next 10 years, the need for new tools and incentive programs to free up that spectrum, that we encourage through incentive auctions the ability to move that spectrum to highest value use, and that we use those auction proceeds to reinvest in some of the key infrastructure requirements of our country, chief among them the goal of a national public safety interoperability network. And we're seeing the power of this in simple ways. I had the honor and privilege of seeing firsthand in February of this year when I announced the Text for Baby program. A very simple idea that young women that are pregnant should have access to the information they need to have a healthy pregnancy and should not be restricted because of their inability to access a care provider. So a collaboration of philanthropists and organizations like Voxiva came together and formed a coalition that said, if you enter in 511-411, send a text message, the word baby and your due date, or bebé in Spanish, that you will get three high-quality messages a week that will keep you in a healthy trajectory over the course of your pregnancy and through the first year of your child's life. Over 60,000 women have signed up for this service since we launched it, at zero cost to the American taxpayer. It's government as convener to leverage technology, data, and innovation to spur change that benefits the economy and the lives of everyday Americans. It's why we're seeing new commitments to not just wireless infrastructure, but wired. We have an initiative that's underway, again, at no cost to the taxpayer, a research and development project in Case Western Reserve University, where the university has extended or adopted a 104 of the poorest homes in Cleveland and is offering them 1 gigabit access, leveraging this ultra-high-speed networks on campus, the Internet 2 and Lambda Rail networks, to see how we might create a test bed for entrepreneurial innovations and applications that will transform these folks' lives. When I visited the campus, they had the first round of those, a telemedicine application to link young people and poor families to specialists that would otherwise be very difficult for them to access, even though they're only a few miles away from places like the Cleveland Clinic. They could be years away from an appointment, given how difficult it is to get access. It also means that in the context of our need for infrastructure, that we're mindful, as the president said in May of last year, that we focus on the importance of cybersecurity as a key factor in our nation's digital infrastructure. In my responsibility as chief technology officer, it's pursuit of game-changing strategies that will protect our nation's digital infrastructure. So earlier this spring, myself and then President's Cybersecurity Coordinator Howard Schmidt put out a call built on research that we had conducted in a collaborative manner over the course of the past year to focus on three principles of cybersecurity, ensuring that we have a new approach to defense when it comes to attacks on our networks, and that is what we call a moving target strategy. In other words, our perimeter defense strategy can only take us so far if we can contain and minimize the damage if such entrants are brought in, that might be a more effective strategy. Tailored trustworthy spaces to create a safe place within the internet to allow us to do more secure computing and transactions, and to fundamentally look at the incentive problem as to how and why we can catalyze more investment to ensure that cybersecurity is a key factor of our overall ecosystem. It's also ensuring that we translate our learning not just into the economy writ large, but into the public sector. And you can see in our work around cloud computing specifically, we have adopted an all-hands-on-deck approach. The National Science Foundation has put research dollars into the hands of professors all around the country to build new and more secure cloud-based applications. And we have a government procurement leg that is focusing on simplifying and streamlining the government's ability to adopt cloud computing strategies. The mixture of these two has come to the head in the president's commitment to catalyzing entrepreneurial activity in this country. And a key lever in our support for entrepreneurs is to free government data. I want to share with you a case study in how we are opening up entrepreneurial opportunities out of our data by telling you the story of the Health and Human Services Community Health Data Initiative. The Department of Health and Human Services has a very simple mission. That mission is to improve the health performance community by community in this country. Now, part of that is by us establishing programs, insurance programs, investments, and so forth. But it's also about empowering you in your community to have the information about the performance of your community so that you can use it to catalyze change neighborhood by neighborhood. How have we done this? Well, we've opened up all of the roughly 2,000 or so pieces of data that describe the health performance that are historically had been locked away and inaccessible by the American people, and it made it as accessible as humanly possible. And within 90 days, we held a forum where Secretary Sebelius and I had the pleasure of listening to about a dozen or so innovative applications that were born out of simply reusing the data that was available in government, but in a way that was more productive because it had tapped into this small business and large business entrepreneurial ecosystem. Just as an example, Microsoft Bing announced their Bing Health Maps program. We have had a database called Hospital Compare that tells you the quality of care at the nation's hospitals. But you have to visit hospitalcompare.hhs.gov to learn about it. Microsoft Bing incorporated that data into searches so that if you search for a hospital on Bing, you will have automatically pop up the key data elements that came out of that database. Who would have known, for example, that there's a metric we track, how well did you sleep at night in that hospital? And I gave this speech in New York. Not a single hospital in New York had higher than 50% satisfaction on how well did you sleep at night at the hospital. I had no idea that that metric was available. The point is, we can tap into new and creative ideas. Whopping cost to the government for this program? That's right, zero. It's also about leveraging a new tool. Traditionally, government acts in grant making or procurement. This president has called on us to think about a new and entrepreneurial way of engaging the American people in advancements through technology, data, and innovation. And we've done so by unleashing a new concept in federal government parlance, the uses of prizes, challenges, and competitions to achieve our policy objectives. We're in the middle of our first major challenge that was launched days after we announced the new policy. The First Lady said, "I'll be the beta customer," and announced in her Let's Move campaign to address childhood obesity that one of her key components of success is to close the information gap between what we eat and what our whether at the child, at the kids level and at the parents level. So we unleashed the Apps for Healthy Kids competition. We have a data set of the nutritional value of 30,000 food items sitting at the Department of Agriculture. We've released this in machine-readable format, and over 100 games and applications were submitted for consideration for a whopping $60,000 in prize money. As an example, I'm a judge in this, so I can't pick winners and losers just yet, but I highlight one. Smash Your Food. Smash Your Food tells you that when you look at your meal and you smash it, it tells you exactly what the salt, sugar, and oil content was so that you have a sense for what that means for your health care. An interesting and interactive game. Young people are playing with these games online. They're giving feedback. I had my wife help me judge with my 3.5-year-old, and she explains to me what I'm eating for dinner is not healthy for me now. All to the good. Every one of these applications are available for you to play with at appsforhealthykids.com. And again, we didn't do much other than call for this challenge, put a little bit of prize money, and tap into that data set and to the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people. It's why Matthew, Holt, and Indu were in the background right there. What's up, my people? Matthew and Indu said, wait a minute. You're not the only one that can do prizes in competition. Why don't we take this strategy forward? Matt and Indu run the Health 2.0 conference, and they said that we will organize a developer challenge that will support private sector challenges that don't cost the government any money but are their own versions. For example, the West Wireless Institute has just announced a $10,000 prize for personalized wireless health applications. They're also focused on how these applications could benefit our nation's veterans, because many of them receive care through telemedicine and remote monitoring. There are a whole range of applications that are available, and in a matter of months, we will have gone from concept to applications that are available for the American people that will benefit their lives, and we will celebrate the winning applications back here in Silicon Valley the week of October 3rd to the 10th. But I want to share with you before I wrap up a few final observations about how we're going to catalyze breakthroughs in areas that I said are all hands on deck. And I highlighted two examples. I wanted to do healthcare and energy. The smart grid is an area the president has said will be critical to our long-term economic future as we think about our energy challenge. We believe the intersection of technology and the smart grid or our energy distribution system will provide value to the American people in a number of ways. We believe the smart grid has the potential to help reduce consumption. Folks will be more aware of their energy consumption patterns and will be hopefully energized and incentivized to reduce that consumption. We're seeing early results from this in markets as we speak. We see the opportunities of the grid to help us introduce renewables into the grid more thoughtfully, electric vehicles as they come into our homes so that they can manage the transmission load, and a whole range of quality of service and quality of delivery of energy capabilities that will be born out of a more successful and vibrant smart grid. Our $4.5 billion federal investment in the smart grid leverages $5.5 billion of private capital for $10 billion in deployments that will be going across the country. And I highlight you just this is a fun little sort of iPhone app kind of thing. In Massachusetts today, as we speak, 3,000 homes have access to this kind of technology where they get real-time data on their energy consumption, and it's accessible to them with a very modest investment by the utility company in this program that we've put forward. I have the honor and privilege of leading the President's National Science and Technology Council focus on technology, and we will be releasing a strategy for the smart grid later this fall. It's also about ensuring that we catalyze breakthroughs in healthcare IT. We have identified several areas that we need to see breakthroughs. Chief among them, how do we get physicians to adopt technology that they like and will use? And secondly, how might we create frictionless communications tools so that they can communicate patient data with permission and privacy controls with their colleagues, with their patients, with their health systems, so that we have a more sophisticated and more modernized infrastructure. I had the pleasure this morning to join Governor Schwarzenegger in the announcement of the California Telehealth Network, which is just one component of our larger vision for how we're going to transform the nation's healthcare system. But I want to end with a more fundamental principle and why I'm challenging you tonight to participate in these endeavors. I share this with you because the first time I visited with us a year ago, a whole range of meetings basically resulted in this. We don't really get involved in Washington because I'm not so sure we're going to get much out of it. It's all wired for the insiders and the folks who know how this stuff is played. It's not worth us pursuing procurement opportunities or grant opportunities. We'll just best do what we do here successfully, and that's innovate and succeed in our economy. But the answer to that is it's not sufficient. My job when I heard that feedback was to fundamentally reduce the friction associated with your participation in Washington. And so I'll end with a final observation about Bob, Dave, and Andrew. Three guys that work at a nonprofit here in the Valley called West Ed, who found out that we were releasing government data, in this case, the XML files for the Federal Register, which by happenstance, is the nation's newspaper for what's happening in the government. It's not the most accessible document. Basically, the lobbyists are really smart about this thing. It's a big thing. You got to read. It's difficult. These three young men said, hey, let's see if we could develop an innovative solution. At the same time, there were apps contests that we had seeded. Apps for America, sponsored by the Sunlight Foundation. Apps for Innovation, sponsored by the Consumer Electronics Association. And this band of merry men found that their application ranked at the top of the list. the AOTUS, the Archivist of the United States, caught wind of the ways that they made the Federal Register more accessible. And he said, wait a minute. I don't want to go build some convoluted website that's going to probably not do nearly as much as your approach will do. Why don't I just deputize you to run and build the federalregister.gov site? And these volunteers said, hey, we'd be happy to do this. 3 months after they won the competition, they were designated by the archivist to help build out the strategy, and the site went live in July. And it's actually much more accessible. The American people now have an easy tool to figure out what's happening in their government so that they know when to participate on rules, how to figure out if there's grants and contract opportunities in ways we haven't even imagined. The point, we are tapping into the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people because this president has called on us to do this, and it is my job to connect those ecosystems and ensure that we are delivering results for the American people. Thank you for your time. I look forward to our questions. I'm sorry I went a little long. All right, Mike, bring it.
Well, thank you, Anish, for sharing your very energetic insights with us. My name's Michael Moritz. I'm a managing member at Sequoia Capital, and I've got the pleasure of moderating this evening's question and answer session. So let me begin, Anish, with one question that puzzles those of us here in Silicon Valley who work in the world of technology and look out across the rest of the country and know that we're in this incredibly wonderful place that we all can call home, and that in lots of other states and cities around the country, there are far greater problems than we have to contend with here. And some of us sometimes scratch our heads about how all the work that technology companies that working in Silicon Valley can help areas in America that have cripplingly high rates of unemployment. And I'd like for you to help us connect those dots.
I have a mentor by the name of Desh Deshpande who has a term of art that I think helps capture the sentiment. And he calls for a need for contextual innovation. Contextual innovation is that the people who live in parts of the country that you're describing as outside of Silicon Valley have a good handle on their challenges, but they may not have access to the platforms and capabilities that might help them address those challenges in new and creative ways. When I served as Virginia's Secretary of Technology, a good deal of my time was spent in our more rural parts of the state. And as I had shared earlier today, I was with a group of folks at Twitter and Facebook and a bunch of places to talk about platforms. And I remember the owner of a small business called the Pink Pony said that his sales of T-shirts had gone up dramatically because he had learned to build a Facebook page and a presence that allowed people who had been of and are from the Eastern Shore of Virginia to connect back to their roots, and he opened up a channel for new business opportunities. So while the folks that I met with today may not have had a direct hand in, you know, selling a software package to the owners of the Pink Pony, by enabling this kind of innovation, that young man's business is more successful today than it would have been, and I believe that same principle is adopted in community after community. I could go on and on about scientific and technological breakthroughs, but for example, I have high hopes, as you saw from my remarks, that the advanced manufacturing potential, specifically around the use of modeling and simulation software, could bring more competitiveness to the nation's manufacturing sector, so that manufacturing jobs in this country, in the heartland of the country, will be benefited by access to high-performance computing capabilities if it could find a way to make them more accessible and available for their supply chain. So there are a lot of answers to your question, but I believe contextual innovation gives us a framework to translate the platforms that are built here and to make them relevant for jobs opportunities in the country.
Thank you. So there are a lot of questions here from the audience, and I will begin to throw some of them your way. Here's question one. I've heard it said that every engineering and science degree from an accredited U.S. university should come with a green card stapled to the diploma. Would you favor such a policy? And if so, would you promise all of us you'll lobby for it when you go back to Washington.
Thank you very much. Yes. Let me make this observation about immigration. The president has heard that sentiment directly. It is absolutely understood on all corners of the policy debate that there is a desire for competitiveness and human capital is a key factor. The challenge has been thus far, we are committed to a comprehensive approach to immigration reform, and that, as you might imagine, with all other policy matters, requires coalition building and a whole series of activities so that principles like you've outlined are clearly important but are necessary to have a larger coalition to address the challenges of immigration that this president is committed to addressing. And by the way, we have in small pieces and parts tried to make it a little simpler. We've streamlined some of the visa requirements for scientists that are visiting for short-term purposes. We are trying to find ways to be more creative about how we think about the many of you have talked about the investor visa or the startup visa. We've opened up a dialogue about how we might do that and what we can do administratively within the legal constraints. So we're going to work at this issue, small and big, but the president's commitment is to getting the immigration system right, and that's critical for the prospects of our economy.
And that last sentence, I think, would be echoed by everybody here who fears that every single day costs us an opportunity to import another talented immigrant to help start another company. Different topic. Healthcare. When, asks somebody in the audience, when will I be able as an individual to control all of these medical records of my own medical history in digital form so that I'm in control and responsible for my own health?
Yeah! Who said that? Woohoo! In fact, that is a policy priority of this administration. So let me describe for you two parts. The president announced, as part of the Recovery Act, roughly $30 billion of incentive funds to convince doctors and hospitals to adopt information technology that would allow them to achieve what is called in policy circles their ability to be a meaningful user of the technology to advance our healthcare system. We've gone through a year and a half debate. What are the rules that should govern what constitutes a provider being a meaningful user of IT? Patient engagement is a key core requirement if you wish to access the incentive funds. And that specifically states that a patient is entitled to an electronic copy of his or her medical record upon request. And then a whole series of other things about alerts and messages. But we didn't just stop there. 3 weeks ago, the president was addressing the Disabled Veterans of America, and the president announced that by October of this year, every veteran in the United States will have access to a blue button that will be made available on the veterans page that will allow them to safely and securely download their own healthcare data that's in the veterans health system that they can choose to do with it whatever they wish. And what my brothers and sisters Indu and Matt have announced is that there will be a prize or a challenge that a nonprofit Markle Foundation will announce or has already announced that will call for developers to build blue button readers so that when the veterans download their own data and have it in their own possession for their own control, that there may be ventures, private sector oriented or nonprofit, where they could upload that data and add value. So that's a long answer to your question, but I am amen to that question, and we've committed to that through policy levers that we have available. Yeah, come on now.
I'm beginning to understand why John Stewart called Anish the administration's answer to George Clooney.
Oh, come on. Come on. That's a party foul.
Hard-hitting question here from some bottom-line-oriented Silicon Valley chief financial officer, I
Excellent.
Think.
Excellent.
The U.S. CTO office is a new position. Forgive me for asking a basic question, says the questioner. But what's the budget and staff of the CTO's office?
This is an exceptional question because the answer is the marginal cost is zero. Now, let me explain. The White House, like every organization, has bureaucratic branches. The White House Office of Science and Technology Policy had been in place since the 70s. And that's an operating entity that's been around the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, et cetera. The head of technology, the associate director for technology in that office, is funded and is a Senate-confirmed position with about a dozen or so staff members. And that's been the budget that's been there forever. The president appointed me to that role. But to create the National Chief Technology Officer, he said, I'm going to shift the bureaucratic pieces, if you will, by naming you assistant to the president, which means there are privileges of being one of 25 assistants to the president that are the final stop before material reaches the president for his consideration, that you will sit as a board member of the National Economic Council with members of my cabinet and the Domestic Policy Council with members of my cabinet. So he took an existing infrastructure and cost structure and elevated the position itself by creating the opportunity for it to have a more leadership role on a range of issues, economic and domestic, and to do so as an important signal to the industry as being a chief technology. So it actually was no new dollars, but a reallocation of priorities that meant that the president said, Anish, I want to hear from you before we, as the final voice before a material hits my desk.
So chief financial officers, as you know, never have just one question.
Yes.
There is a follow-up.
I like them.
What are the major deliverables and success criteria for the United States Chief Technology Officer?
So my colleague Tom Khalil says this best. We are effectively policy entrepreneurs. So the output of our office are policies that the president will unveil. Policies take several forms. They're often manifest in budget. So when we release the fiscal 2012 budget, you would look to see if it represents the spirit with which I've described our philosophy today, the manner with which we enact policies in areas like the smart grid and healthcare IT, as I said earlier, the rules around giving me the authority to have access to my own data, those are policy deliverables. But it's also about catalyzing an ecosystem which may or may not take advantage of formal government action in the form of a law or a regulation, but actually is the convening power, and I point to the Indu-MAT combination as an example tonight, where we're not actually doing much except for convening and celebrating. So I actually measure, first of all, the number one measure of success is am I serving the president? That's who I serve. And in that regard, I serve the American people through the priorities that he's set. But it's the set of policies that we are purporting. So you heard a bunch of areas where I have interest, and you can look at them. Where are we on IT infrastructure, on spectrum, if you think that was good or bad? And I can go down the list again.
So a lot of people here are interested, it turns out, in cybersecurity,
yeah,
which
brilliant.
I suspect is a topic you've thought about a fair amount. And one questioner asks, given that the business of government is migrating more and more to the World Wide Web,
yes,
what's being done to better secure our technology infrastructure on a local, regional, and national basis?
Let me begin with the federal government. We have been operating under a set of legislative rules that have encouraged world's best practices in cybersecurity inside the walls of the federal government. So we have been deploying technologies to identify and to manage our risks, if you will. We have been investing in operating capacity, reducing our number of access points and thinking about our the number of internet connections and so forth. So we have been adopting principles of best practice inside the federal government, and that's not new to the Obama administration. This has been a carryover that has been a priority that is carried through from President Bush on. So we have been very active in maintaining the government infrastructure success. That is the responsibility of my colleague, the Chief Information Officer. His name is Vivek Kundra, and he has operational responsibility and strategic responsibility for the $80 billion the federal government spends in IT, and he has ownership and responsibility in collaboration with the Department of Homeland Security. My responsibility is to see how we identify breakthroughs and game changers, as I had outlined in my comments, that focus not just on the government as customer, but could actually permeate into the private sector writ large. And so you'll see more announcements in the weeks to come. I don't want to preview them too much, but we will, in the spirit of tapping into the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people, you will see more about how we can engage you to help us solve the challenges in cybersecurity.
So, turning from cyberspace to outer space, one audience member, which is one small step, one audience member would like your opinion on this. In light of President Obama's space policy, what's being done to release startup funds for entrepreneurial space startups?
So this is an active debate in the United States Congress. So the president administered a strategy that dramatically improves our scientific and technological advantages in the area of space exploration. So for those of you that follow the NASA budget, historically it had been, traditionally, it had been a scientific and technological engine of innovation. Increasingly, it had adopted an operational mission, literally running routine flights. And the operational side of the house had dramatically increased the share or proportion of the overall budget. What the president had suggested is that we can rely more cost-effectively on the private sector to handle a number of the operational missions. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, if I don't know if Elon Musk is in the audience or someone from his team, but his team had successfully launched one of those test rockets to prove that they are capable of delivering payload. And so the president has called for an increased reliance on the private sector to provide some of that operational support to the space station and other areas that NASA had been focused, and to restore NASA's mission in scientific and technological breakthroughs to produce that next innovative call to action and the specific call to help us achieve the next set of, I wouldn't call them necessarily planets, but the, you know, meteors and other areas where we might have an ambition to hit with the successes that we're going to see out of the ecosystem. And the Congress is debating this as we speak.
So unlike every other questioner, there's one person here brave enough to put his name on the question. And he's a high school student.
I love it.
And his name is Rohan Chandra. And he'd like you to...
Wave. Thank you.
Anish, he'd like you to answer the following. How do you think that the U.S. can advertise its technological innovations to the more rural parts of the country and get people there to actually use the technology?
That is a terrific question, and I thank you for raising it. We have a couple of answers. I'm going to start with the grassroots answer. The President's Educate to Innovate campaign that he announced in November included a program privately financed called National Lab Day, nationallabday.org. And it was a grassroots program that would allow schools in every community in America who need help to focus on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, whether they need help financing equipment in their labs, inviting mentors to inspire the children, any of the above. And nationallabday.org was essentially a matchmaking service where thousands of volunteers log in and say, what's happening in my school district and where I can bring attention? The number of rural schools that are participating is astronomical. To understand at the young person's level how we can achieve these kinds of breakthroughs. That's number one. Number two, part of my responsibility is to ensure that our economic development, so that's bottom up. Top down has been, the country has an infrastructure of economic development professionals who are there to market the capacity of this country, not just domestically, but abroad. And it's increasingly incumbent upon us to ensure that those economic development professionals have the wherewithal to bring those messages out so that you can see the fact that it's actually cheaper to get gigabit broadband connectivity in Danville, Virginia, than it is in Washington, D.C.
Try it on Sand Hill Road.
Yes, sir. But I'll give you one final observation. And there's a third dimension. There's also the desire to grow ecosystems. Now, it is always difficult to come to Silicon Valley and to say we're going to have 50 Silicon Valleys throughout the United States. That's an aspiration and it's a dream. But we have tried to find ways to take some of the active ingredients of success that is at the heart of the ecosystem and to encourage communities to demonstrate that they can establish that type of capacity. So we launched, under Secretary Gary Locke's leadership, I had the pleasure of participating in this announcement, the I6 Challenge. So we're giving six $1 million prizes to the communities that best demonstrate how they can build ecosystems that will promote technology, data, and innovation entrepreneurship that are in large part, in fact, required by this competition to focus on distressed economic parts of the country. So it's a long-winded answer to your very thoughtful question, but it's got to be top-down, bottom-up, and catalyzing using these tools like prizes and challenges to get the country moving again.
So this next question looks like a mini business plan.
Ooh.
So I'm going to keep that one and go to the next one.
Yes.
The next questioner says, this is a simple question, but I know, Anish, it's on the minds of lots of people here in the audience tonight and around the Valley, which is, what are your views and the administration's views on net neutrality?
Well, I will begin by, I have to give a little bit of a caveat up front. The Federal Communications Commission has jurisdiction over this issue, and they have an active proceeding underway. And they are an independent body of the government, so it is actually inappropriate for me to comment more specifically about the provisions that they're grappling with by way of rulemaking. But that's not a sufficient answer for your question. So what I'd like to do is, if you would indulge, I'll remind the American people, our audience tonight, the president's commitment to an open internet. So I want to share with you just some of the key philosophical principles, and it's up to you if you want to dig deeper or what have you. But I'm with the caveat of the constraints that what I'm allowed to say. The president has been absolutely clear from day one, and even before his status as president in his campaign era and his tenure as senator, that we as a nation support an open internet that is focused on driving innovation, investment, free speech, and consumer choice. The president has already stated publicly that we support the FCC's efforts to establish the sound and enforceable rules that will make these principles reality. But I will highlight two caveats. Caveat number one, we acknowledge that the underlying legislative framework, which is the 1996 Telecommunications Act, was not actually designed to address the needs of today's internet. So we're in an environment where rulemaking is done on a foundation that isn't designed for where we are today. Which therefore leads to my fourth point, and that is that we acknowledge, and this is an important point, that there is an imperative in this country now to take the time and energy to develop the right set of policies that will ensure that the internet remains an important driver of the nation's economy and as a platform to improve the lives of everyday Americans. And we have a number of key specific provisions within our definition of the open internet that I'd be happy to spend more time on if you wish. But again, specifics about net neutrality are right now a matter before the FCC.
There are a bunch of other topics people want to hear your views on, so let's move on. Somebody says this, Silicon Valley's home to entrepreneurial biotech initiatives and innovations.
Yes.
How can this spirit...
I visited one yesterday.
How can this spirit not be squelched by government regulation that can be too heavy-handed and outmoded?
First of all, I have to do my job, okay? So job number one, as many of you saw, increasingly our medical devices are powered by information technology.
Yep.
And there is a regulatory regime at the Federal Communications Commission and a regulatory regime at the Federal Food and Drug Administration. So we were pleased to announce that in end of July, the director of the FDA, Peggy Hamburg, and the commissioner of the FCC, Julius Genachowski, announced a statement of principles for how they would collaborate to ensure we get it right, not wrong, as we get into the regulatory framework. And by the way, the FDA similarly published probably a 45-page treatise on how they would think about scientific and technological advancements in medical devices. Second, the administration has been very focused on the power and potential of breakthroughs in biology, in nanotechnology, and information technology. And as I mentioned to you earlier, the President's Council of Advisors of Science and Technology, chaired by Eric Schmidt and Shirley Ann Jackson, held that public forum where they raised this exact same question. In other words, the entrepreneurs, the professors that were describing for us the world as it should be 10 years from now, as they were to see it, given their breakthroughs, acknowledged that increasingly their innovations are occurring at the seams and that our regulatory framework may not necessarily work well at the seams. So the president called for, and we were in the midst of developing, an emerging technologies working group that may sound bureaucratic, but it's a policy priority, where the rulemaking lead of our administration, Cass Sunstein, I myself am responsible for the technology section of this, looking at nanotechnology, a number of other areas. And this program, this working group, is meant to surface, to get ahead of the problem, so we're smart about the regulatory challenges and the policy framework, so we get it right. Now, we may not always get it right, but that's why we have a key and fundamental principle to transparency. So when we issue rules and we look at the role of government, we will be absolutely transparent in seeking public input so we gather the intelligence of the American people and get that information back. It's a key reason why I believe our health IT rule struck that balance correctly. We got great public input, made some changes as a result, and I hope you will hold me accountable for performance in this area as we proceed. If there are areas that we've failed, let me know now. As we move forward, we were keeping an open and strategic dialogue with the American people. This is very critical to our economy and also important to protect the safety of the American people.
It looks like we have at least one visitor in the audience from San Francisco, judging by this question. There's an ongoing debate on the Consumer Privacy Bill. Will you choose, yes, number one, big online advertising businesses, or, number two, consumers' online privacy?
This exactly mirrors the discussion on net neutrality. The independent commission, the Federal Trade Commission, is in active review of commercial data privacy regimes. They've held public hearings. They've had a public hearing here in Silicon Valley. They're engaged in a process. I have the honor and privilege of leading our policy framework in the administration. Once the FTC concludes its work, my responsibility would be to provide advice and counsel to the president on presidential actions relating to the report that they may issue. So I cannot in good conscience make comment about a particular view on privacy policies that are in front of the independent FTC so that I'm not, again, influencing their work. But rest assured that's a high priority in my role as chief technology officer and one that I'm very pleased is involving a number of agencies who are already at the table to think through how we get this right. If you want a preview, you can look at the health IT rules for privacy for health records as a model for how we are proceeding, at least in that domain.
So we do have a visitor from the Central Valley. This question comes from Manil Tambi from UC Davis, and she says, I'm a female currently pursuing a degree in computer science and have found that my classes are only about 10% female. Do you have any plans to engage more women in technology and how?
That's why Ursula Burns and Sally Ride are key members of this new program to catalyze breakthroughs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It's no coincidence that they're taking a leadership role because it's, again, an important part of the president's commitment that for us to see the success we envision in our economy, you can't get there unless more women and more minorities find a way to connect and participate. And there's a whole set of activities we are trying to do to promote this endeavor. We have a Council on Women and Girls that's got to focus on these issues, chaired by the First Lady and by our Office of Public Engagement lead. I work very closely with them on innovative technologies to ensure that more women can connect in the workplace. That's why we're promoting telework policies so that we have more accessibility in these areas. That National Lab Day I described, one of the first recipients of that program was a woman who was a stay-at-home mom, but she was a trained neurobiologist, and she was sort of struggling with how she could reconnect and give back. And so she found National Lab Day as a way to come visit a local high school and mentor children, and actually is getting them published in a scientific journal because she's using that as an outlet. So in ways big and small, we are committed to this. No silver bullet here, but we've got to do more, and I think I hope we've set the right tone.
A question about privatization. Somebody here would like to know whether, given the decline in state and federal budgets, whether it's going to be possible to privatize and make more efficient some of the IT operations of the federal and state governments.
Well, I come from a history where we did this. I came out of the Commonwealth of Virginia, where we embarked on the nation's largest IT infrastructure partnership in the country, 10-year, over $800 million program focused on how we can basically achieve more with less. We had a framework in Virginia that allowed us to engage in public-private partnerships a little bit more creatively than a traditional government procurement. In fact, we allowed people to come in with their own ideas unsolicited, and that those ideas could then be heard and effectively competed. So if you had a wacky concept on how you could save our IT infrastructure costs in Virginia, you had the ability to present that idea and then actually had a chance to compete for it. So we're doing it in the federal government. We're looking at new and creative ways to leverage cloud computing so that we can do more in achieving our results with less investment in infrastructure and more in application. And so, my colleague, the Chief Information Officer, is in a very aggressive mode right now to right ship the federal IT budget, and a key factor in that is a thoughtful and effective use of private sector assets.
Someone here asked the interesting question and poses this observation. A large part of American life is the time we spend at work. And this questioner would like to know whether your charter includes considering innovations and initiatives to improve the quality of life at work.
Well, I mentioned the telework program. So inside the federal government, there has been a question about how we leverage technology to enable a more nimble workforce. As many of you know, we had a program or a problem in February. We called it Snowmageddon. The federal government was at a standstill. Literally, you could not connect with the offices because they couldn't get to work. But the United States Patent and Trademark Office, which has over 80% telework, was at 80% productivity. And so they still came to work and got the job done virtually. So I have been applying in collaboration. The president convened a workplace summit, family-friendly policies, productivity strategies. He's chartered the HR director for the federal government, John Berry, who's partnering with me to ensure that we're bringing emerging technologies to the discussion. And that's my modest contribution to this debate. We have to be focused and narrow in what we focus on. So I know tonight I've said yes to everything, and that doesn't probably give you the sense of prioritization. I'm not doing as much in your work statement stations, but where I can, I've helped in the federal area as asked.
So unfortunately, we've reached that point in the program where we have time for just one last question, and that question is the big burning question that most people in the audience have been yearning to ask all night ever since they saw you, Anish, put your BlackBerry in your pocket. And as the nation's chief technology officer, people would like to know from you, who has the president's email address?
That's confidential. I have top secret clearances, and I'm cleared all the way up, and I am sealed. I apologize for not giving you the answer to that.
So I hope you enjoyed this evening's AHA program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Anish Chopra, U.S. Chief Technology Officer, ARIC, a global law firm, our audience here in Mountain View, and those of you joining us on the radio. I'm Michael Moritz, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.